Trans Panel, which is about emerging challenges to watersheds. We're having a small technical difficulty here, but I think you all have the slides, and if you don't, you can try to borrow that QR code from a neighbor who has them. And I'll hand things off to our moderator, Georgina, to get us started.
Hi. At one point, this was going to be called Emerging Watershed Challenges, Climate Contaminants and More. Is it still being called that? Okay. And more. It sounds like we're going to freeze and make it even better than climate change and contaminants. We've got a great panel here, and I think what we're really going to try to do is delve in a little bit more, and I hope get everybody some good story ideas and better ideas about how to cover these watersheds, because if we've learned one thing from the last panel, it's that they are very, very complicated. And climate change, in particular, is making all of those challenges and all of those complications even more complicated. So each panelist is going to introduce themselves, talk about what they do, then I'll probably ask a couple questions, and then we'll open it up just like we did in the last panel. So thanks for being here, and thanks to all of our panelists.
Chris Clayton, I'm Ag Policy Editor for DTN, the Progressive Farmer, based in Omaha, Nebraska. Just briefly want to say I'm very happy to be here. It's always an honor anytime SEJ or somebody from SEJ invites you to speak on a panel. It's always a great meeting because there's so much in-depth reporting from the people here, and just wanted to get that out of the way. I'm here to more or less demystify the Farm Bill and talk about Farm Bill programs and watersheds. And demystifying the Farm Bill, anytime I talk about the Farm Bill, I'll just simply talk about the U.S. Department of Agriculture. That is the Farm Bill. Anything that goes in there is their programs. There was a really good story last week from the Ag and Water Desk. Some other people did some reporting as well on Environmental Working Group looking at watershed issues and the EQIP program. And EWG's kind of like us. They're out there trying to find clicks. That's what they're doing. And so are they touching upon, EQIP not necessarily, meeting all the watershed needs. EQIP wasn't necessarily set up to be the watershed program for USDA. But right now, though, because of not the Farm Bill, but because of the infrastructure bill and because of the IRA, USDA now, more than any other time, has got this huge pot of money that they have available for different watershed programs that they did not have before. There's a watershed program. The woman from American Rivers was talking about some flooding issues in different communities. USDA has a program, a small watershed flood prevention program that typically would get about $50 million a year. Now, because of the infrastructure bill, that program's been bumped up to $500 million. So, 10 times the money that they've had available. They've had initiatives for the Mississippi River watershed, the MRBI, as we call it, Great Lakes Initiative, Chesapeake Bay, all basically have been relatively underfunded given the amount of acreage and the farm acres that they have in those watersheds. But now some of these programs have got a lot more potential money. The one that USDA is a world of acronyms, but the one that now is the Regional Conservation Partnership Program. That was started in 2014, RCPP. And that was basically because of the Mississippi River Basin, they decided to go ahead and create this program. And it's a competitive program for people to apply for. It takes a lot to get in and make your applications for this program. But because of the IRA program, the funding for that has basically gone from $250 million a year to $750 million a year. So EQIP has bumped up from basically, you know, has been added another, you know, $1.6 billion in that program as well. So right now there's just going to be a ton of money that is sitting there for different watershed potential projects. Unless we see Congress, in writing the Farm Bill, try to claw back some of that money. And that is a very big debate going on right now, particularly in the House of Representatives, which is Republican controlled. They're looking at cutting costs. They're also looking at shifting money to other things that farm groups want in the Farm Bill. So they're looking to maybe claw back and move some of that money out of these conservation programs. But right now, USDA has potentially more watershed potential than ever before, and I'm going to shut up and move forward.
Hi, everyone. I just want to start by saying thank you so much for having me here. I am so honored to have been invited to this event, and I'm looking forward to meeting all of you in person throughout the event. I also want to caveat that I'm not going to talk too much about the specific policy issues in the Colorado River Basin, even though that is my focus, because there's another individual on this panel who I think is going to go a little bit more in detail on that. So I'm just going to focus on the work that I am doing. So who am I, and why am I up here with all of these incredibly qualified folks? Well, I like to describe myself as just a girl who is obsessed with water in a really dry place. But more specifically, I'm a content creator and environmental activist using the TikTok platform to educate the public about the water crisis in the Colorado River Basin and to advocate for sustainable and equitable solutions to our water management woes. I studied water policy in college, and I founded a club on my campus dedicated to water resource issues. I have also been a certified raft guide for almost 7 years, and I founded and captained the first junior women's raft racing team in the U.S., and we represented the country at the World Rafting Championships in 2017 and 2018. I was also working as a raft guide when the Gold King mine spill dumped 3 million gallons of toxic sludge into my home river and turned the entire thing bright orange, and it made national headlines. All that's just to say that I really, really love rivers. And I know this next statement is going to be a little contentious because there are so many people from so many different river basins in the room right now, but I personally believe that the Colorado River Basin has some of the most amazing and beautiful rivers and landscapes in the entire world. After college, I tried repeatedly to get involved in water policy in my little corner of southwestern Colorado, and I was consistently told to wait my turn. I ran into the same roadblocks that Janae mentioned in the Q&A. Many of these organizations are structured very top-down and do not allow for watershed community members to actually have their voices heard. And because of this, young people are really not being engaged in many of the conversations surrounding water management, especially in the Southwest. And that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, because it's our water future. We are the ones who are going to feel the impacts of the decisions that are being made in the Colorado River Basin right now. And we have a responsibility to be informed and involved. I also noticed that, quite frankly, a lot of the information that is being shared about the Colorado River Basin is just being discussed in an echo chamber. Many of the organizations that are responsible for managing our water and disseminating information related to that are failing miserably at breaking it down into terms that people can understand, and more importantly, in a way that people find entertaining. And I mean, sure, people like us in this room who are already invested in environmental issues may be listening, but that's not really the demographic that needs to be reached. We already know what is at stake. We're already prepared to make sacrifices to protect our water resources. That is not really the case with the general public. It's also important to note that, according to the Associated Press, nearly 75% of people under 25 check social media for news on a daily basis, and comparatively, only about 25% of them check local or national news every day. And I want to acknowledge that, like Daniel said in the first panel, there has been a surplus of great reporting in the Colorado River Basin. But at the end of the day, even the best reporting doesn't make a difference if the people who really need to hear it aren't being reached. So with all of that in mind, I created a TikTok platform in April of 2022 just to discuss water conservation issues in the West. And since then, I have been working nonstop to provide relatable, entertaining, and accurate content to my followers. I believe my platform is proof that young people care about these issues and are willing to be engaged, but only if you're speaking their language. And that is what I think makes my platform very unique. I'm communicating large concepts in easy to understand terms with humor to keep it entertaining. And this will be key in getting the general public on board with the changes that will be necessary to address the crisis in the Colorado River Basin. I also often use my platform to discuss issues that many elected officials or appointed officials, like water managers, would shy away from. For example, it is well known amongst most people that have been following this issue for some time that irrigation for forage crops, like alfalfa, accounts for at least one-third and maybe up to two-thirds of all of the water that's used in the Colorado River Basin. But these officials are often very wary of discussing the sustainability of that industry in the face of diminishing flows, because that's going to be a really difficult conversation, and it's not very politically expedient for them to do so. However, in the absence of trusted sources providing transparent information on platforms that people, especially young people, are actually using, misinformation is running rampant. There is literally a guy on TikTok that claims that water is generated from the core of the earth, and that this water is called primary water. And he alleges that the water issues in the Colorado River Basin are manufactured. It's a manufactured crisis. And he says that they could just pump the so-called primary water if they wanted to. And I know this sounds laughable to most of us in this room, but I'm sorry to tell you guys that this dude has over 100,000 followers. People are listening to him. I do my best every single day to fight this misinformation in every way that I possibly can on my platform. But the reality is that this misinformation will continue to proliferate until trusted sources like water managers or journalists like yourselves start utilizing these platforms as well. So in closing, I just want to ask all of you to consider the ways that the media landscape is changing and how you can best use new forms of media and communication to reach audiences that otherwise may be disengaged with your work. I was going to share one of my videos for you guys to kind of see what I do, but we're having some technical difficulties, so perhaps at the end. And I just want to caveat that this is one of my latest updates about the Colorado River, and it's been pointed out to me that in this video I refer to a supplemental environmental impact statement as a study, not a statement. And I want to clarify that I do in fact know the correct term is statement, but I found that my followers understand and relate more to the word study. And I know this seems like a trivial substitution, but this is exactly what I'm talking about when I say we need to communicate in ways that the general public can actually understand. So, anyways, without further ado. Well, you all can look me up later.
Definitely be looking you up later, Teal. Thank you. Hi, everybody. My name is Jesse Ritter. I am the Associate Vice President for Water and Coasts at the National Wildlife Federation. If you are not familiar with the Federation, we are the nation's oldest conservation organization working across the country. And what makes us a federation is actually our network of state and territorial affiliate organizations that help us set our policy agenda and are often our first partners on the ground. So I've been at National Wildlife Federation for about 8 years now. I started my work really focused actually on the Mississippi River Delta ecosystem and the land loss crisis in southeastern Louisiana, as well as broader efforts related to the BP oil spill restoration dollars flowing to the Gulf states. And I do still work on those issues, but my team now actually looks much more collectively and comprehensively at federal policy issues around water, coastal resilience, disaster resilience, working carefully on issues related to agencies like EPA, the Army Corps of Engineers, FEMA, and NOAA. And we've begun to really look up the Mississippi River in a lot of our work and our efforts and are starting to expand our work throughout the basin. So I'm primarily going to focus on the Mississippi today in my comments and on some broader kind of federal policy issues, but I did just want to say that NWF is also working on the Columbia and to a lesser extent on the Colorado, and so certainly have colleagues that could share a lot more about those systems too if that were of interest to you. So one thing, just to kind of start a few reflections, it was said on the last panel, you know, that in the face of climate, that we really need to reframe how we relate to water. And I couldn't agree more with that. One thing that I've noticed in my work, and I do think this is actually starting to change, but there has been a large disconnect, I think I've seen, in the communities thinking about funding, working on climate change and working on healthy water and healthy watersheds. The one place where we've consistently had crossover is, of course, when there's been a problem. There's too much water. We have a flood. We have a hurricane. There's not enough water. There's drought. There's, you know, water scarcity. There's wildfire, right? But in terms of looking at water and healthy watersheds as part of the climate solution and part of our climate resilience, I feel like there's just been a little bit of a siloing that's happening. And I do think it is starting to break down, and I think reporting like yours can help to start to break that down further. So I was just going to share in this opening comments a few reflections on the Mississippi River specifically. And some of this may be very familiar to folks, and others may know less about this system. This is obviously a system that is a huge artery for commerce in our country, supporting millions of jobs, really important to our economy. And as we saw, it drains a huge percentage of the lower 48 states in this basin. Because of how important it is for commerce, and in fact enabling that commerce, it is a highly, highly, highly manipulated system. And I know the same can be said for some of these other systems that we're going to talk about today, but I wanted to paint a picture for what that looks like on the Mississippi. So at this point on the Mississippi River, federal levees have cut the river off from 90% of its natural floodplain. The upper river is a series of highly managed pools. It used to actually be a free-flowing river with rapids. There was a waterfall at one point in history. It's now this series of pools to enable easier navigation on the upper portion of the river. The width of the river's middle reach has actually been cut in half through the extensive construction of what are called river training structures or channel training structures in order to allow for a deepening of the channel and the path, again, for commerce. And the lower reach has actually been shortened over history by about 170 miles to, again, expedite the path out to the Gulf of Mexico. And we have, of course, those same levees have really disrupted some of the natural delta building processes and the replenishment of sediment into the surrounding wetlands, contributing to the land loss crisis in Louisiana. So just to kind of give you a sense of all of this, part of what all of these manipulations have done is really created the opportunity for the expansion of agriculture to further transform the landscape. And agriculture is really, obviously, a really important economic driver in this part of the country. As a result of that, we've seen a significant loss of river habitats, decades of decline in water quantity, or challenges with water quality. We've also seen an increase in flooding in a lot of the communities along the river. So that tells you just how changed this system has become over the past several centuries. Despite all of that, though, and something that I think sometimes gets lost in how the general public thinks about this system, it still is an ecological gem. It's providing habitat for more than 870 species, many of which are threatened and endangered. It is, even in its currently altered state, it defines the flyway for 40% of the nation's migratory waterfowl and 60% of migratory birds, and its waters host a quarter of all fish species in North America. And so, just to underscore, despite all these manipulations, there's still a lot of really important ecological services, wildlife habitat that the system is providing. One other observation that I think sets the Mississippi apart from some other rivers, we've been doing a lot of scoping work as we try to decide where we might want to do more on the ground work across the basin. And we've conducted a lot of interviews over the past year and a half. And one thing that really comes through is that in general, and there are many exceptions to this, it seems like a lot of members of the public really don't feel particularly connected to this river. They don't necessarily feel that their identity is being a part of the Mississippi River Basin or near the river. And it's not really hard to understand that when you think that in a lot of stretches of the river, it's largely hidden from view. Despite its size and its sweeping importance along much of the river, what members of the general public and population are seeing are these large earthen levees and not actually necessarily the river itself. Access is hard in many, many places along the river. And folks actually view it more as a source of problems. They associate the river with the flooding events that have become more frequent. They associate it as a conveyor of pollution or of emerging contaminants and chemicals. But, and this is really important to our work as advocates at Federation, we also heard that this is something that people want to change. They want to start seeing this river as something more than a transportation corridor. They want to start having it be something that they can access, celebrate, and really something to be enjoyed. So those are some things that we've kind of learned in our work so far. I also want to just point out, because I do think it's a really important piece of this, the Mississippi River, and there were some slides somewhere in this deck kind of showing just the concentrations of socially vulnerable populations. Some of the most impoverished communities in our country are in the Mississippi River Delta and in the lower portion of the Mississippi River in particular. And that's something I think that is really important that we keep in mind, not only in ensuring those voices are lifted up, and obviously in reporting, but also just in our work in general and making sure that those folks are centered in our conversations around solutions. So there's a lot more that I'd like to say, and hopefully in discussion we'll get a chance to. My final point is just that as we think about, you know, opportunities for spotlighting issues that deserve more coverage, I think that there's a lot of untapped potential here in talking about this interaction between Mississippi River management and river health and community safety. I think a lot of folks view this system as, you know, first and foremost a transportation corridor, and it always will be that, and it needs to be that. It's important that that continues to be a primary function of this system. But there are a lot of ways that we can maintain those incredibly important purposes and make significant improvements for ecological health and for community safety, even in the same process. I worked for a long time on the Everglades and on coastal Louisiana, like I said. And I find it just so fascinating that in these other ecosystems around the country, we are now spending billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars to basically undo the manipulations of previous generations. And really allowing nature to kind of do what it was doing in the first place, naturally. It's an engineering feat to do that, to undo the manipulations that were there in the first place. And it's expensive, and it's inefficient, and it takes a long time. And so I do question how many times are we going to kind of relearn the same lesson. And with climate change, I think we have an opportunity, not only on the Mississippi, but on all of our other systems and on our watersheds, to kind of challenge the assumption that the solution to these changes in the environment that we're seeing is to double down on manipulating the system versus looking for ways that we can incorporate more of the natural processes strategically to actually allow nature to come back into the picture as part of the solution. So thank you, and I look forward to our discussion.
Good morning. My name is Justin Hayes. I'm the executive director of the Idaho Conservation League. I've been with ICL for about 23 years. I was originally born here in the state, and this is the state that I love to call home. The Idaho Conservation League is the state's oldest and largest state-based conservation group. We're not the local chapter of some big national, although we're very fortunate to work closely with many big national groups that have outposts here in the state and the region. As the Idaho group, I'd like to welcome you to Boise. I'd like to encourage you to leave this building at some time during the day and walk down to the Boise River. It flows right past here. One of the really amazing hallmark features of the city of Boise is its relationship to this incredible river. And a little further away, the Boise foothills covered in snow still. This is a really wonderful place. Idaho has incredible rivers. Someone dared to say that a place other than Idaho had great rivers, and I'm not sure that's right. We can fight later. The Boise is a significant tributary to the Snake. The Snake is the largest tributary to the Columbia. We're in the ancestral homelands of the Shoshone, the Bannock, and the Paiute people. And this area is very much changed from how it was in the past. And those are really interesting discussions to have and to think about what we need to do to protect and restore this watershed at the small level of the Boise River, the medium level of the Snake, and at the larger level of the Columbia. This really is a huge watershed, and there are tremendous challenges, and there are incredible opportunities. I'm gonna just talk about some of the interesting things that are happening in this basin, hopefully as a way of sharing some information, but also teasing some questions out of you a little bit later. Like many of the watersheds that you're from and that other speakers are from, these are heavily used water systems. Agriculture has been mentioned many times, so that means water use. We put a lot of strain on these water systems. We're in the arid west here. Boise is a desert. We get less than 12 inches of rain a year. Don't be fooled by the snow in this moment and the lot of water in the river right now. Water quantity is a real stressor on this system, and climate change is making that even more so. The changing patterns and timing of precipitation, whether it comes as snow or rain, really makes a big difference. And when it melts off of snow and enters into the systems, when does that happen? Does it surge early and overwhelm the storage systems that were built with past water expectations, or does it come late? These are big changes that we're really grappling with here and there in West, and especially here in Idaho, in Southern Idaho. Hydropower. You know, you're in the service territory of Idaho Power. We're the only state named after a utility, by the way. That's a joke. But, you know, much of the energy that's consumed in Idaho and the Pacific Northwest comes from hydroelectric dams. Those have really significant implications for river management and the fish that live in them and the people along the river and in these communities. I also want to talk a little bit about some pollution issues. We'll talk some about toxics and contaminants, I think, and the cultural and spiritual significance of these rivers to people who have been here since time immemorial and those of us that are here now. But these are really special places, and their future is really being decided right now. They've been harmed in many ways. As I mentioned, there are tremendous challenges, but there are incredible opportunities. The Snake River flows out of Idaho and into Washington, where it merges with the Columbia. But here on the southern Idaho part, in the eastern part of our state, it's a blue ribbon trout fishery. Maybe some of you have been over to the Henry's Fork, or maybe you've fished or seen promotional tourism videos where the state touts incredible clean water and amazing opportunities to catch fish and refresh yourself there. But by the time that same river flows across the southern arc of our state and gets to its western border with Oregon, that river is so contaminated that the state of Idaho frequently issues advisories cautioning people to not get wet in the river. And if you do get wet, wash it off. That's kind of hard to do in some of these places. We have tremendous problems that are exacerbated by climate. Warm water, sluggish water, low water flows, high nutrient loads, and that's really what's happening in southern Idaho. It's the ag belt, if you will. It's the dairy belt. In the last decade or so, Idaho has become the third largest dairy-producing state in the nation. We have over a million dairy cows and beef cattle in just a small area, the area that we call the Magic Valley, and it's sort of the southern, central southern Idaho. Too much manure in too small of a place, washing into the river, soaking down into the aquifer. It's a really significant problem. A little further downstream, as the Snake River goes into Washington State, it encounters four federal dams, a huge source of controversy and opportunity. I'm sure many of you have read about this. There'll be some speakers tonight, a congressman from Idaho and a tribal leader. And then there are opportunities to rest the conference to talk about some of these issues. But the way in which the river has been harnessed for industry has had incredibly negative implications for many of the people of this region and for the natural resources of this region. So we'll talk a little bit about dam removal hopefully a little later. And then, of course, the Snake joins the Columbia. Well, in the headwaters of the Columbia, it's a transboundary river, right? That river is coming out of Canada. And there's some really interesting toxic contamination issues up there right now, especially around selenium. How Canada manages coal mining and some of the other extractive industries that take place in that country affects water quality in our state and our country. And that's a really interesting State Department level issue. When Biden got together with the Prime Minister of Canada not that long ago, this was a topic of discussion. And then there's also an incredibly important treaty being renegotiated right now between the United States and Canada, the U.S.-Canada Treaty. You know, when that treaty was first crafted, its focal points were energy production and flood control. Many people in the basin now want to make sure that as that treaty is renewed, there are components in there that look at ecological function. Is this river running like a machine, or is this river running like a river? And all of the good things and all the messy things that entails. So with that, I'll stop talking and say that I'm looking forward to questions where we can dive into some of the contaminant issues and also some of the water management issues and fisheries issues.
Well, thanks. Good to see you all, and thanks for having me. My name is Peter Culp. I'm the managing partner of a mission-driven water law and policy firm focused out in the Western United States called Culp & Kelly LLP. We also run a related technical management and finance consulting business called Blue Shift that works together with the law firm in a joint venture, and we essentially try and build solutions at the intersection of water and climate in the Western United States. We work extensively with cities, with NGOs, with foundations, with a number of agricultural interests, tribes, investors, others. But our big focus is in the Colorado River, which is, I think, why I'm here today, to focus on that. I've worked on the Colorado River for now about 25 years. It's an amazing place. What attracted me to it was that it was this place where really embodied the reclamation vision for control of nature. And it seemed like the place where we were most likely to see that vision begin to run aground in a really dramatic way. And we're beginning to see that now. Along the way, I've been privileged to be involved in most of the interstate negotiations between the seven basin states, around the management of the Colorado River, and many of the international negotiations that have led to now five new agreements between the U.S. and Mexico, as well as efforts just to change the way in which we understand risk in the system, improve the models, deal with the changing baseline problem that Daniel was describing earlier, just try and begin to rethink the relationship between humans and this river. A number of you have written eloquently about the challenges that we are facing in the Colorado River in the face of climate change. I know a number of you have focused a lot on the sort of really intricate issues that are sort of embodied in the relationships between the basin states, between the United States and Mexico. It's not easy work. It's greatly appreciated. That journalism, I think, is really vitally important. But one place, just in terms of what we might talk a little bit about today, where I think journalism could actually really help right now, is also in helping to look beyond the conflict in this system and beyond just the declining reservoirs. And that sort of those sort of big images that I think the public is seeing and sort of learning about the system. And the reason I say that is because I think actually a lot of the issues we now face in this basin, and which in many ways I think is a sort of microcosm or maybe macrocosm of a series of issues we face around the Western United States, is that many of those risks actually really do now diverge from this popular narrative that we've constructed in the United States around supply versus demand, urban versus rural, farmers versus investors versus cities, cities versus the environment, right? Most of the solutions we need now involve essentially cooperation between sectors and across sectors, which is, I think, something that's really difficult to achieve in the midst of what is a real crisis and a real challenge, where people are, I think, frequently just sort of think of themselves as being pitted against each other, when in fact they're actually in many ways on the same side. The other thing I think we see a lot of is that the risks we face in the system are also really departing in important ways from the kinds of problems that the water infrastructure that we've built and the institutions for governance that we've built were actually designed to solve. Just as an example, right, the legal and institutional systems that I've spent most of my career working with really are only designed to deal with this tiny fraction of the total hydrologic system that we're managing. So for the Colorado River Basin, we all, maybe now it's like the big argument is sort of like, well, I divided up the law of the river divided up 16.5 million acre feet, and really there's only maybe 13 or 14 historically, and now there's even less, right? But the reality is that if you sort of add it up, basin-wide, about 170 million acre feet of water falls on the Colorado River Basin every year as precipitation. It varies widely year to year, obviously. But, you know, of that, only, not even 10%, less than 10%, is actually reaching a stream channel, in many cases, even reaching groundwater, to the point where we actually start to think about it and worry about it. And so this whole struggle we're having is essentially dividing up that less than 10% without worrying very much about the 90% plus that is, in fact, the hydrologic system. And that's, in some ways, why climate change is so challenging, because what it's doing is affecting the 90% in really dramatic ways. And so even when the temperature goes up, even by small amounts, you know, the hydrologic math is such that a fractional change in that hydrologic system, you know, 1 or 2%, 1 or 2% is like 20% of the water supply, all of a sudden. And so addressing that is going to require transformation in a lot of different ways, at a pretty significant scale, particularly in agriculture, because of how much water agriculture utilizes. And a lot of investment, and particularly in communities that have, I think, largely been left behind in a system that, you know, as famously says, water uphill, flows uphill towards wealth and power. And it turns out wealth and power sort of follows the water. And so, you know, in that environment where we actually need, and we have an economic system that in some ways is helping to generate the hydrologic challenge we have because we are not making the investments in the places the water is coming from the ways that we need to. And that story, you know, just goes, I think, a long way beyond the sort of historical law of the river and the sort of popular narratives that we built around. So, I mean, in the face of all that, I mean, there are a lot of stories, I think, that could and maybe need to be told about the Colorado River. It's stories about how people are adapting to changes in the landscape and to scarcity, and how that adaptation is actually maybe leading to a better basin over the long term. How land managers, public lands, private lands elsewhere, are beginning to reverse sort of centuries of now land management issues that have created many of the hydrologic realities we're now facing, in sort of getting at that unseen 90%. And some of those stories are now emerging in the media, as you guys are profiling municipal conservation efforts or the efforts of individual farmers who are experimenting with new crops, or new ways of managing ranch lands, or tribes that are conservation organizations, restoring streams, and so forth. What I think is really potentially an opportunity now is to begin to expand on those stories more in the Colorado River Basin, and to begin really looking at what is it going to take to implement the kind of change that we're going to need at scale. You know, for example, what are the financial resources and the market development assistance and the technical support that's going to be needed to help beef and dairy shift probably away from water-intensive forage production? That is, in fact, about 65% of the water use in the Colorado Basin is growing cattle feed. And that's not to criticize that, but it's a huge number. And it's not, and for many of the people engaged in that industry, they're not doing that well economically doing it. What are the priorities for investing in forest management as a way of managing wildfire and also as a way of stabilizing watersheds, thereby protecting the water supply? And why is that not happening, right? Because we know about this problem. We've known this problem for a couple of decades, and yet we're still struggling to get forest restoration done at the scales that it needs to be done. How do we get the basic tribes, the resources they need to sort of build water infrastructure, provide drinking water to their citizens, and to the many people on reservations that are currently living with water supplies that are just unacceptable in the United States. And how can we begin to partner together across sectors to sort of execute the kind of large-scale, multi-benefit projects that are going to have to be done, that are going to keep food and fiber available, that are going to protect municipal and industrial users, and that are going to maintain the quality of life in the Southwest that is badly needed for those populations, but do it with less water. And maybe most importantly, this was alluded to on the last panel, are the federal agencies and the state agencies who now have a significant amount of resources available to spend on these things, are they really equipped to deliver on the promise of those resources? Do they have enough staff with the right qualifications? Have they adjusted the permitting and the grant-making processes? I've worked on a number of them recently, including the RCPP, which ended up being 160 pages long. It was well beyond the technical capabilities of the groups that we had to help with. Are they actually, are these things happening in a way that's actually going to allow the big investments to occur? Because that's a huge obstacle for many communities. How can Congress help? If we're looking for a safe space for political leadership, that's potentially a safe space because there are a lot of people that need those resources. So anyway, from my perspective as a practitioner, the basin really does need your help and your storytelling skills to sort of help paint a picture of what this place could be if the right investments were made in the right places at the right time. And many of those investments are going to require taking a long view, looking beyond just like Arizona to California over the next couple of years. But how are we going to deal with aridification over time? And many of those solutions are also going to develop at the ground level, not in the interstate conversations, which, while I am welcome them, I honestly think are potentially less relevant these days than what is actually happening between water users. There are a lot of folks out there that we work with that I know would love to help you all tell those kinds of stories. I'm happy to help try and connect folks to that if it's of interest. Thanks for the opportunity to be here for the conversation.
Great. Thanks, everybody. Amazing. I have tons of questions. I will try not to monopolize. I will only ask a couple, but first, Teal. Help. what do we do? No, seriously. Can you, you mentioned that we should be using these platforms, but how do we actually engage, and how do we, we need to motivate younger people to get involved and be readers, consumers of information. What do you think we should be doing?
Well, first off, immediately after I stopped speaking, I realized it didn't say my name. So my name is Teal, and I mostly go by Western Water Girl, which is my username. I think the best way to approach that is by doing some research. There are news organizations that are already utilizing TikTok and other social media platforms, and I want to be really clear that TikTok isn't the only one. I'm just saying that these social media platforms are where most young people are getting their information from, so it's important to meet them there. But a great example of an account from a reputable news organization on TikTok is the Washington Post. They have really, really great content. It's really funny, it's really engaging, it's short, it explains really complicated issues in really fun ways. I would just recommend finding organizations that are already doing that work and just emulating what they're doing.
Thanks. I write about agriculture and climate change. I promise I won't geek out on that, but just Is Congress really going to claw back the IRA? Chris?
That's not really.
I think if Senator Stabenow, the chairwoman of the House or the Senate Ag Committee, has anything to say about it, no. But you know, the House will try. They will put forward a bill that will claw back some of this money. But, you know, the House is going to get tied up in a snap debate. They're going to be gridlocked. They will pass a bill purely with a Republican majority, and it won't fly in the Senate. You know, the same repeat that we had in 2018. I think it'll just, song remains the same. But the Senate's going to try to get 80 votes, and if they get that, you know, they'll be locked in, and I don't think Stabenow worked to get all of that money in the IRA. She's not going to want to give it up, you know.
Thanks. Okay, and one question for the rest of Jesse, Justin, and Pete. Okay. And I hope this generates some ideas for coverage and helps us get some story ideas. And in the case of each of the watersheds that we're representing on this panel, you know, you use different terms, but harnessed for industry is something I think Justin said. And what do you see as the biggest flashpoint in your respective basins with those industries right now? How do you get over those, you know, conflicts? Because these are corridors for commerce and transportation and agriculture, agricultural uses. If everybody needs to be at the table, but half of those everybodies are industry, how do you move forward? So I'll start with that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think, you know, one of the forcing mechanisms, one of the potential flashpoints is just the realities of climate change and how it is testing the delicate balance of these engineered systems. You know, we've had, even in recent years along the Mississippi, 2019, for example, like really significant flooding events. And when those things happen, there is an opportunity, there is a moment where, you know, communities and federal agencies that have a say in these things either go, let's try something different. We saw that in the case of a levee setback in Missouri after the floods in 2019. I think the Nature Conservancy was involved in that. So, you know, or we double down and we say, we're gonna replace this levee, do emergency levee repairs, we're gonna build it back taller, stronger. So I think climate forces some of these decision points and conversations, certainly where you have, you know, kind of big events like flooding. I think that in terms of how you do it, when everybody needs to be there and everybody needs to be bought in, I mean, that's that's the million-dollar question. One opportunity coming up that I think could hopefully be harnessed, and were to 2020, Congress authorized a study on the lower Mississippi River, the point of which is to evaluate multi-benefit projects, very explicitly look at projects that are not single purpose, not just for navigation, not just for flood control or ecosystem restoration, but look for projects that can accomplish multiple objectives in one. And it's a study that crosses multiple Army Corps districts, I think 7 states, and requires public engagement. In 2022, Congress said that study should proceed at full federal funding. And there's already some money in hand to start it. So this is just one example of an opportunity that we may have to kind of step back and say, okay, let's get everybody at the table here and let's actually try to talk about a new way of looking at things, a new way of managing the system. I think a lot remains to be seen on whether or not that actually happens, but the more folks that are tuned in and participating, you know, the better the likely outcome.
I think that a lot of these ag or industrial uses are often in states, it's a water quantity fight. And water regulation is often, although done in partnership with federal agencies that often regulate many of these dams, state water law kind of rules the day. And so, you know, in Idaho, first in time, first in right, senior people get the water before junior people. So there's all kinds of system issues that are challenging. But the quantity issue and the water quality issue
really is becoming exacerbated by climate change. Less reliable water supplies on the quantity side are affecting the amount of water that's in the river to assimilate pollution, to keep temperatures in rivers down, which is critically important for toxic algae blooms and aquatic health and fish issues. So we're seeing an increased convergence of quality and quantity issues. And they cannot be solved to the detriment of the other, because it makes it worse, it spirals out of control, there's terrible feedback loops. And there are advocates on the quantity side that will fight with the quality folks and vice versa. So this is really a time to recognize that the systems that we have either created or relied on are changing, and we are going to need to change our expectations around that. Some really interesting things have happened over the years here in Idaho on this, and I'm not advocating for what I'm about to talk about or against what I'm talking about, but people have recognized that the once mighty Snake River, as it flows through southern Idaho, is really just a shadow of its former self, and the river needs to be managed in some ways as a smaller river. And so habitat restoration projects have taken place in several areas where they've said the original watershed is too wide. We never fill it with water anymore. And so we have this really broad, shallow, slack water system. And can you actually recreate a river channel in the former river channel that allows it to act more like a river? Might create moments where that river is healthier. We have spring runoff like everyone else, so you have these big surges, and that's incredibly important. But those are things that the state and federal agencies are often trying to really reduce the frequency of and control so they can have that water for irrigation purposes. So we need those spring freshets, though, and we need our rivers to be able to act a little wild every once in a while to reinvigorate itself and move sediment around and move pollutants out of it. So we're going to have to find ways of having quality issues and quantity issues resolved so that they complement each other as opposed to continue to fight each other. That's my take on that.
Very well said. Couldn't agree more. I mean, maybe just for the Colorado River, you know, which is the typical flashpoint for the fight over quantity. I mean, the way you resolve that conflict in some ways, I think, is by recognizing that we don't actually have a water source problem. We have a water use problem. Right? And I think the good news is, you know, because we've over-allocated this system, and now the baseline has declined. The good news is that I think the industry that you're talking about uses a tiny fraction, really, of the overall supply. And I don't say that to defend the use, because everyone is going to change the way the water is used. Cities are using more water more efficiently. Industry is using more water more efficiently. But what there is the opportunity, I think, created by that is a tremendous opportunity for investment in the places that have sort of been left behind, particularly rural sort of agricultural communities and tribes. And there are a lot of opportunities for that investment to occur. If you can sort of look beyond, or if we can look beyond as a sort of collective, beyond the notion that what we're doing is engaged in a zero-sum game here. There are a lot of places where cities, for example, can make investments in Indian tribes, not just buy water from them, which is what we've been doing for a while, and frequently not at prices that they really are where they should be. Because tribes may have been in a position where they haven't necessarily been able to use their full allocations or develop them. Frequently, they're parting with water at a price that's lower than their neighbors in a sort of nearby farming community offers relation to the water. But we can solve that by turning away from buying water from each other and making investments in each other to use water better. Help bring people along. Same thing is true, I think, with a lot of industries. They can produce tremendous value on a single acre foot of water, and that means that we can embed in
landscapes where the water originates, to sort of be able to do a better job there. So, I mean, I think the conflict is basically inevitable if our goal is to use as much water as possible, which has historically been the goal. And that's what prior appropriation was designed to do, is to essentially, along with the settlement of the Western United States, is like, we'll create this system that encourages the most rapid possible exploitation of the resource. But if we can actually recognize that in this new situation, the goal is not necessarily to use as much as possible. The goal is probably resilience. And we get to resilience by making investments in each other, as opposed to fighting.
Thanks. We can open it up now. Wow, hands are shooting up. There's Aaron.
Hi, I'm Aaron Jordan. I'm a reporter in Eastern Iowa. I had a question for Justin. I wondered if your proliferation of dairy production in Idaho, is it connected at all to California's new requirements about reducing methane emissions? Has that industry migrated to Idaho for that reason? And because it's relatively new, are you coming up with any solutions for how to reduce the runoff from that industry?
Thanks for that question. The industry's migration to Idaho has been going on for a while. It didn't just happen in the last 5 or 6 years. And it predates the concerns around methane and methane emissions and digesters and stuff. But there are some drivers, I think. Idaho traditionally has prided itself, the state government has prided itself on being kind of a low regulation state. It's kind of the opposite, at least, of what most people think of California. So I think that there was sort of a northern migration towards a presumed less regulatory environment that might actually be real. Although we are in a desert, to play off Pete's discussion there, we don't have a water supply problem at all times. We have a water allocation and use problem. So there is actually water for this industry here, often, not always, but often. And so, their real estate, their farms, their holdings in California were incredibly valuable as cities grew and people looked for places to build new subdivisions and homes. So they were able to sell, move to Idaho, and buy a much bigger operation or build a much bigger operation. In the last 20 or 30 years, the average size of a dairy in Idaho has gone from what would have been a big dairy of a couple hundred cattle to now we have many 10,000 plus dairy farms. Some individual operators own multiples of those. I think that the number of dairy cows has increased and the number of small farms has decreased. They're just being assumed by larger corporations that are family farms too. Of course, they're family corporations. But it has been really hard to get ahead of the pollution problems from the industry. I don't think any of the operators out there are trying to cause an environmental problem. They are struggling with an aggregation of their industry. They're struggling with just the sheer logistical problems of moving millions of pounds of manure around. When you have this many cows in a concentrated place, you import food from a huge area, and that food brings with it all the nutrients that the cows need, and the cows eat it, and they poop it out into a small area. And so there's just logistically and economically almost no way to move manure back into a large enough area that it is the beneficial nutrient for fertilizer and ag growth that we all want manure to be. It's just being stockpiled, if you will, that's causing the problem. No one's trying to cause this problem. It's happening for reasons, though, that we can address if we put our mind to it and are willing to spend money on it.
Hi, my name is Chantal Riley, and I have a question for the gentleman or anyone who can talk more about it, who mentioned cattle feed. And I think you said something along the lines of 65% or some percentage around there of the water in the Colorado River is being used for cattle feed. I had no idea. I'm very surprised by this. Can you talk a little bit more about that? This is a question for anyone, and what possible solutions can be put in place to deal with it.
Yeah, I think that is about the number. It's hard to get an exact figure on because and it sort of depends also on whether you're talking about the river, like what's coming out of the river versus what's being pumped out of the ground. But it's in that range, in that sort of 60-65% range, goes into, we believe, forage crop production. Now, it's not all cattle, but forage crops. That sort of other animal-related industry. I say this without getting in too much trouble. that's not necessarily right. That's not necessarily a problem, right? You sort of recognize that forage crops, when forage crop production includes, for example, pasture grass irrigation in the upper basin of the Colorado River system, which is supporting, in many cases, pretty important ecological patterns and range animals that are pretty expanded. They occupy a significant amount of the headwaters. That said, we don't necessarily need to irrigate the same ways. Right? There are really interesting experiments going on with wet meadow restoration as a way to store water in the headwaters regions and kind of restore what used to be beaver-dependent ecosystems that were really good at storing water in wet meadow systems. We're actually very resilient to drought, that have been degraded through a process of mostly erosion, as well as the extirpation of beavers and historical grazing practices and many other things. But if you can, some of those restoration techniques provide the opportunity, not necessarily to use less water, but to change the way in which water is moving through the landscape. And better storage, more reliable sort of downstream flows, maybe they even use more, but they use it in a way that's more ecologically beneficial. Similarly, there are ways of producing feed that are way more water efficient, including some interesting experiments that are going on with essentially indoor production of cow feed in vertical towers that are essentially sealed off where the water loss is not from the evapotranspiration from the plants, but the water is actually just leaving the building embedded in the plants themselves. It's a huge transformation. But I think the other thing to recognize, which I think is interesting at the moment, is that you can talk to a lot of ranchers that we work with. None of them are like really doing great right now, in part because of some changes in the market, in sort of commodities markets downstream from that, that have created some real challenges for people who are working on the landscape. Right now, the way we expect those lands to be managed is that somehow those lands are going to get managed, but all of the management that we need is going to get paid for by people producing cattle and selling them beef, potentially when a lot of the value of the value chain is now being captured downstream from those people on the landscape. I think that some of those things can be ways that can be really beneficial to people that are out on the landscape, create real opportunities to make investments in the landscape and to be helping people who manage large ranches that are used for beef production to actually provide the services that we need in the watershed. So, I don't want to characterize the solution not necessarily as like, what we just need to stop forage production. But I think we can rethink the way that it's done. And because it's such a significant quantity of water use, working on the economics around that may be as important as almost anything else we can do.
I want to start off by saying I agree with everything that Peter just said, but I also want to add that in the United States, we do export a lot of those crops, and we're only one of two countries in the entire world that exports alfalfa. So there are definitely changes that could be made. And I also want to just stress that, like, you saying that you didn't know that is exactly my point. Like, there are parts of this problem that are not being discussed because it's uncomfortable for a lot of those water managers to say those things directly. That's why it's really important that we're reaching the general public with this information. So, like, for example, the number one comment I get on all of my videos is that it's Gulf. The Gulf is using all of our water. Which I know is kind of laughable, but like the general public genuinely has no idea where this water is going. And that's why it's really important for us to break it down in these like really simple to understand terms. Like, this is how much is going towards forage crops, which is not often said in those really simple terms.
Administration announced to the Colorado River Basin states that we are officially done fucking around and it's time to find out. In case you live under a rock and you don't know what I'm talking about, then let me fill you in. Last year, federal officials announced that the Colorado River Basin was approaching a complete doomsday scenario. So they asked the 7 states of the Colorado River Basin to come up with a plan to reduce water consumption by 25% by next year. But in January, the deadline for coming up with a plan passed, so the federal officials had to proceed without them. The Department of the Interior and the Bureau of Reclamation, which are the federal organizations that are responsible for the reservoirs on the river, have to conduct a supplemental environmental impact study on any of the actions they might use to enforce reductions throughout the Colorado River Basin. In the draft of the study, which they just released, they examined 3 possible alternatives, the first of which is no action, which would mean relying on existing drought contingency plans to enforce reductions and not going beyond that. It's highly unlikely that they'll choose this option, but they do have to include a no-action alternative in almost any environmental impact study. The second option is to enforce reductions based on the existing system of prior appropriation. This is what California's been arguing for during almost all of these negotiations, because it would mean the other lower basin states would bear almost all of the reductions. But this third option is where things start to get pretty wild. They're proposing that the cuts in the lower basin be shared equally, as the same percentage amongst all of the states. Which is already how the upper basin operates in times of shortage. And I don't think it's possible for me to overstate how groundbreaking this would be, because it would go against the very heart of the Colorado River Compact, which guaranteed that California will get 4.4 million acre feet before anyone else in the basin. This is also pretty hilarious to me, because this would be more detrimental to California than the 6 states proposal that California already shot down. The Biden administration is basically like a parent saying, if you can't play nice and share your toys, then nobody gets them. I do want to make it clear that the feds haven't actually endorsed any one of these plans in particular, but they will be studying the potential impacts from each of them and choosing one by the end of the year. In my opinion, it seems really unlikely that they'll choose the no-action alternative because they've already indicated that cuts have to be made. And I also don't think they're going to choose the second option of running with the doctrine of prior appropriation, mainly because that would mean Arizona would bear the burden of almost all of the cuts in the lower basin. And a significant portion of that water belongs to tribes of the Colorado River Basin that reside in Arizona. Many of those communities already have issues accessing water, and it would be a PR nightmare for the administration to cut them off even further. Also, the Secretary of the Department of the Interior is the water master for the entire Colorado River, and Deb Holland is the first indigenous person to occupy that position. So yeah, I'm really excited to see how this pans out, and I will definitely be keeping you guys updated as I get more info. Lastly, the part of being a content creator that I suck at is promoting my other platforms. So if you like my content and appreciate the work I'm doing, please go check out my Instagram or my Patreon.
I actually made that sound interesting.
I just wanted to add one other thing really quick, which is that there are other ways to break down this information. You don't have to use TikTok. For example, today, one of the scientists from the IPCC report broke down the report into 35 haikus. And they're so simple, but they really break down all of the data in like a really easy to understand way. Just as another example of ways people can do that.
Programs that you think are deserving of more investment, or whether there are new programs that you think that the Farm Bill should invest in, and specifically I'm interested in the Colorado River Basin, but feel free to take that more broadly.
You know, USDA still currently has its suite of conservation programs that they can apply. Now, in terms of if you're going to try to reduce water usage, maybe you're trying to take irrigated land and convert it to dry land, rain-fed production, or simply idle the land and say, maybe we can just put this in CRP. Conservation Reserve Program, which is an idling program. But there's a lot of pushback right now. There's been a lot of pushback in recent years over the idea of idling more ground. There are ways, though. There have been situations in the past. The Republican River Basin in Nebraska, they used Conservation Reserve Emergency Program to basically get guys to stop irrigating and go to dry land production. But it takes a lot of money to convince them. I was up just this week earlier this week in Washington State. The difference between irrigated wheat production in dry land wheat production, you're going from maybe 150 bushels an acre to 30 bushels an acre. That's, extreme difference for a farmer trying to make money, and everything in the farm bill is voluntary. The last thing in the world you hear from the House or Senate Agriculture Committee is the word mandate. I tried to mandate that people would not grow alfalfa in the Colorado River Basin or something. That would just would not fly. So, and I'm sure others have other views.
I'll just add that, I think there's been a lot of emphasis, and rightly so, on all of this new climate smart ag money and NWF, and many groups worked very hard to support that through the process, and it's a game-changing opportunity. At the same time, I'm channeling kind of my ag colleagues here just to say that the money's one piece of it, but there are kind of still these cultural barriers and understand barriers and kind of understanding and motivation that we need to address as well. We've been trying to do that through work directly with kind of farmer-to-farmer ambassadors. Our Cover Crop Champions program is one example of actually trying to enable, trusted messengers to kind of bring the argument for these practices in addition to, here's the money to do them, here's how you do them, but like why? Why should you care? Why should you want to do them for the long term? And so just that other dimension, I think it's important to kind of keep top of mind and keep present as we're thinking about, really scaling up those climate smart practices around the country.
Yeah, with all that, maybe just one last thing I'd say is that I do think one thing that we are not seeing right enough of yet is enough coordination between, for example, the federal agencies around the use of farm bill money versus other sources of. The Bureau of Reclamation, for example, right now is running, has some substantial money they're beginning to put towards trying to deal with providing for demand management programs or helping folks doing what they call system conservation to put water back into Lake Mead, things of that nature. What you don't see yet is a lot of efforts, I think, just because historically the agencies have been pretty well siloed off from each other. To sort of look at, hey, could we use reclamation money to, say, deal with some of the capacity problems that would unlock a bunch of farmland that could be spent in the basin? Or, could we just address some of the barriers that prevent the programs from working together, like there are some restrictions around being able to use federal money to match other federal money, which then create big issues where you have, local groups that probably could carry out huge projects and programs among farmers and ranchers, among NGOs, but they can't raise the match. And since most of the money floating around the system is federal, if you can't match the So I think there's some places where, in some ways, that coordination maybe is as important as anything else to making the farm bill usable in the Colorado Basin as a, in a way that would really complement the efforts to address the water needs.
Hi, I'm Joey Presley. I'm from a student at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. I have a question kind of for Teal, but sort of for everyone. Teal specifically mentioned like the sounding board or the echo chamber that could be in these conversations. So I'm wondering, like, with TikTok, with that platform, is what tools are available there for connecting with publics that are outside of, I know the algorithm favors people who definitely agree with you and people who hate you and think probably you're a communist hippie. But like, and then in other sorts of activism, how do you, what are the points that resonate with people outside of the agree or hate publics? Thank you.
Well, first off, I think TikTok is a really unique platform because the content that it shows to its users are not always from the other users that that person follows. The For You page really has a very unique algorithm that brings you content that is just subject related to things that you've previously interacted with. So it provided me with a really unique opportunity to reach a really large audience really quickly. My first video that I posted got over 200,000 views. And I did not expect that necessarily. I think it's really nice if you can find a community. For example, I found a community online of other eco-content creators, and they all have their own niche. None of them are also focused on water management, but we all work together to kind of cross-pollinate and share our content and each other's content with all of our followers, which makes a much larger reach. But in general, I think my experience is you would be absolutely astonished at how many people will listen to you if you just start speaking up and if you just use the platforms that they're actually using.
I said something about stories, for just say content, traditional media stories. So we work a lot on the Snake River. I spent time talking about that earlier. And we find that when we talk to the public about a lot of these issues, they don't agree with us. And one of the reasons they don't agree with us is they're operating with a completely different set of facts. So we'll say, wow, that water's really polluted. The state has told you not to let your dog swim in it. And also, the state has told you, don't feed fish caught in that to your children. Those are facts. But most people in the state are not interacting with those facts or not believing them when they are presented, because I'm the one presenting them instead of you all. So I would encourage people to think about stories that are not just the big features, but sort of the drumbeat stories about what's happening in the watershed, how can people be part of this watershed, what are the recreational opportunities, what are the concerns, what's the health of the watershed really, is mercury really an issue, what does that mean for all the families that are down there catching buckets of crappie and feeding them to their kids for, you know, weeks and weeks on end and poisoning them, frankly. So I think it's really important that stories be written and connect to the people who are in these watersheds, not be so high level, what's happening with the farm bill, what's happening in DC, but like what's happening in the watershed where you and your kids and your family live and interact with that water. So, and push back. We see a lot of elected officials who really are invested in the status quo operation of this watershed, whether it's around fish or pollution or water management, and the things that get printed as if they are factual because they came out of a member of Congress's mouth are insane. You know, so it was a really proud moment, I think, when the media started saying, you know, former President Trump, who denies election results and has been discredited, you know, almost like we need to have that sort of arrangement with lies about environmental conditions. You know, people are going to continue to report what important people say, but then I think you need to fact check it right there, not leave it up to someone else to write an op-ed 3 weeks later that takes the person for task for misconstruing the facts. So it's probably kind of the bad news part of the discussion, sorry. We value so much the content that is generated in traditional media sources, and we're so excited to work with folks to generate that. But we are so frustrated when we see things that aren't accurate presented you know, sort of like the he said, she said, tobacco science sort of thing. And you can't really rely on the public to be following these issues close enough to sort out fact from fiction. And I think we all need help and guidance from you guys because you are really well-educated experts at communicating.
The erosion of the media ecosystem, obviously, at the local and regional levels has been very unfortunate, obviously, because it's that very reporting that has gone away. And just a little plug to the Ag and Water Desk, it's exactly what we're trying to restore. So I think a lot of the stories, at least in the Mississippi River watershed, are being told now in a way that they might not have been a year ago.
He said the first bumper sticker he said he saw when he arrived was don't believe the fake news media. We'll take one more.
Yeah, actually, sorry, just one thing just on that point, and then I'll shut up. But I do think that the other piece around that storytelling, I think the facts thing is a real challenge. The other is that I think there is embedded in a lot of the popular narratives a lot of sort of value judgments around water use that I think are worth questioning in many cases. I hear constantly about how cities are, it's essentially golf courses are the problem or cities are the problem. And, and what that ultimately translates back to on the is you have cities that are now looking at, maybe we should turn off the water in our parks, right? Because that's inefficient. It's like turf. The turf is bad, right? But that's also the place where some of the communities that are essentially in the worst economic position have their only positive interactions with water, right? That's where and I will defend the economic value of that over almost anything, any day of the week. And that's not to say that that's a better use than alfalfa production or semiconductors or any of the other things that we need water for. But those things are equally valuable. And I think one of the things, or a real service that journalists can do is to help bring out not just the values that many people place on this thing. Because those resources really matter, not just to produce crops, but they also produce quality of life. And our sort of endless quest for efficiency at sort of the cost of everything else, I think, is part of that same challenge we have around needing to change our goals. The goal of maximizing use, maximizing X per drop, or is it to be in a place we all want to live in?
Yeah, it's sort of like the carbon footprint of flying lots of journalists to Boise. Like, is that going to be offset by all the good stuff we write and the positive impact that has? You got to wonder.
I don't see any other pressing questions, unless I have something quick. I think people are ready for lunch.
Thanks a lot, everyone. The panelists were absolutely amazing and will be great sources for you, except for Chris, because he won't... won't want to be scooped. Thanks a lot.